Welcome to the Precision Guided Podcast, the official podcast of the Georgetown Security Studies Review, where we will cover all things national security, military, foreign policy, and history. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Ryan Wizawati, and today our guest is Dr. Aviel Rochwald. Aviel Rochwald is a professor of history at Georgetown University, where he has taught since 1991. He obtained his PhD at Harvard University in 1987. He is the author of numerous books on European history and nationalism, such as Occupied, European and Asian Responses to Axis Conquest, 1937 to 1945. He is also the co-editor of the two-volume Cambridge History of Nationhood and Nationalism. Our topic today is World War II historical mythologizing. I think it's fair to say that World War II is one of the most talked about historical events in the United States, and today we'll unpack what popular fascination with the war means for policy and scholarship. This topic has taken on additional significance with the invasion of Ukraine. On one hand, Russia has justified their invasion on the grounds of the so-called denazification of Ukraine, and in doing so, they've attempted to reshape understandings and histories of World War II. On the other hand, popular understandings of World War II are deeply ingrained in American strategic culture. The lessons that popular history derived from the war influence policymakers today. To jump right in, what is historical mythologizing, and where does it come from, and why does it seem so deeply ingrained with World War II?
As the name implies, history is composed of narratives, stories. Above all, I think humans are probably hardwired to focus on story making and narratives as a way of understanding the world and of our place in it. Historical mythologizing refers to the sort of reduction of historical narratives to sort of narrowly understood interpretations or misinterpretations of history that in ways that are intended to convey clear and usually simplistic or politically convenient messages. And of course, what professional historians like to do is to pick apart mythologies, standard narratives, break them down, put them together again in other ways, and argue with one another over what the most relevant narratives are, how to interpret them, and how any given story or history fits into the larger fabric of human experience.
And so why are we seeing so much historical mythology when it comes to World War II in particular? It seems like, as I mentioned in our topic introduction, this has been utilized by the Kremlin, but it's also a historical event that's talked about a lot in the United States, and there's a lot of competing narratives over the ideas and the lessons that we should be taking away from this war.
I think the reasons are, you know, primarily the obvious ones, but worth enumerating. I mean, it was the largest scale conflict ever fought in human history to date. Hopefully, it retains that record for the future. And it involved so many countries in so many different parts of the globe. It truly was a global war on a scale and intensity and incurring loss of life and limb and treasure, all on unprecedented levels. So it's understandable and reasonable that it would be a particularly memorable event. And of course, it also was in many of its aspects an intensely ideological conflict. And one in which conflicting ideologies played a key role in instigating in the first place. And as the war dragged on, its outcome came to be seen by most parties involved as holding the key to which values, ideas, kinds of institutions, and countries would dominate the world in a post-war future. And it was a war that involved arguably the most evil and one of the most irrational regimes ever to play a significant role in the history of humanity or of warfare. I'm referring, of course, to Nazism and Nazi Germany and what it represented. And so the war's ending in the defeat of the Axis powers lent itself to a narrative that understood the war as having defeated evil and established something better in its place. And of course, in practice, things were more complicated. I'm not questioning the extreme radical evil of the Nazi regime, but of course, it's easy to look good compared to the Nazis. Unfortunately, radical good never seems to prevail unchallenged in the world, and that was the case during and after World War II, as in other conflicts. But for all of those reasons, among others, the war has taken on an iconic importance and significance in the telling of history in many countries, including this one. It's a war whose outcome also had a profound impact on the geopolitical and ideological structures of the post-war world. So it's hard not to refer back to it in thinking about history since the second half of the 20th century, and by virtue of its iconic status, it's also a familiar reference point. Everyone thinks they know something about World War II, whether they do or they don't, and that makes it convenient for public intellectuals, politicians, commentators, ordinary people to refer to as a way of framing whatever political agenda they happen to be advancing.
I suppose it comes down to history is very rarely black and white, good versus evil. Now, to pull on that strand a little bit more, what do you as a historian view are some of the major themes that American popular history gets wrong about World War II, or maybe not completely right?
Well, a few examples pop into mind. One is the theme of World War II as the good war, which, you know, the grain of truth there, of course, is that, Hitler and his allies really did represent profound and radical evil. So calling it the anti-evil war might not be such a misnomer, but the term good war, can be used to sweep all sorts of unpleasant issues under the carpet. To take the most obvious example from the American involvement in the war, when we think of the really arbitrary and unjust wartime imprisonment of American citizens of Japanese descent on the basis simply of their ancestry, it's hard to use the phrase America's good war when thinking of that shameful aspect of American involvement in the war, just to take the most obvious example. So the notion of the good war and the greatest generation are examples of sort of simplistic myth-making that certainly professional historians have issues with. And those themes can be then used and abused in the service of other agendas, such as invoking the memory of World War II as the good war to justify any other conflict that the U.S. might get involved in subsequent years, no matter how different the context might actually be. Another related myth is the notion that seems to be fairly widespread to the effect that the U.S. entered World War II in order to, quote-unquote, save the Jews, unquote, which is a complete illusion, of course, and one that reflects a kind of a much later understanding of what we now refer to as the Holocaust as being a central narrative of World War II, but that's sort of projecting back onto America's wartime agenda a historical sensibility that was shaped much more by the culture of the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s than the wartime experience. And I suppose a third element, a third example might be the focus on Normandy and the D-Day invasion of Nazi-occupied Europe as the pivotal event in the war. I mean, of course, the definition of pivotal is subjective, and there's no reason not to celebrate the heroism of the D-Day landings, but the role of the Soviet Union in wearing Nazi Germany down and leading to its defeat tends to get airbrushed in sort of U.S. and perhaps West European narratives of the war. For their part, the Soviets and now the Russians refer to World War II as the Great Patriotic War, meaning the patriotic Soviet slash Russian war, and they sort of airbrush every other theater of the conflict out of their own historical memory of it.
So the idea of a good war seems to come up a lot, especially with the invasion of Ukraine and the idea of the denazification of Ukraine, the narrative, one of many that the Kremlin has been pushing. Mm-hmm. So I want to go further into that topic. As a scholar of history and as someone who's written a book on Axis occupation, what is the true story of Ukrainian collaboration, or at least its experience with occupation during the war?
The piece of history that Putin and Kremlin propagandists have seized upon concerns the role of an organization called the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, the OUN, which were actually split into two different rival groups, but which initially collaborated with the Nazis during the German invasion of the Soviet Union beginning in June of 1941. This was an organization that had never won any election in Ukrainian territory. Ukraine at the time was, part of the Soviet Union as a Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic, and what is today Western Ukraine was part of the interwar Polish Republic, whose borders extended much further east than post-1945 Poland's do. So this was a radical, right-wing, fascist-style organization that aspired to lead Ukrainians toward independence someday on territory that, at the time, was divided between the Soviet Union and Poland, and the Nazis saw them as tactically useful allies during their invasion of the Soviet Union, and so members of this OUN organization and its two factions sort of fanned out behind German lines to organize and mobilize support in Ukrainian towns and villages. Their activities were, helped facilitate a number of notorious massacres of Jews in Ukrainian cities and towns in situations where the German army exerted overall control but allowed anti-Semitic mobs a free hand for some days or weeks against the Jewish minority in their midst. And OUN and OUN-linked militias were implicated in a number of these massacres. Subsequently, the Nazis suppressed the OUN's activities, banned it, imprisoned or executed some of its leaders and activists. And then again, when the tide began to turn and the Soviets began to push back west against the Nazis and their allies in 1943, tactical cooperation reemerged in practice in some parts of the military theater between OUN-affiliated militia and the German army. So it's a complicated story, but one in which the OUN nationalists played a very ugly role, both in fostering initial massacres of Jews who were arbitrarily labeled as sort of the ethnic face of communism, supposedly. And then between 1943 and 1945, OUN affiliated fighters also undertook the massacre of thousands of ethnic Poles. And there were some reciprocal massacres, although overall many more ethnic Poles killed than Ukrainians during this internecine warfare, basically behind German lines or between Soviet and German lines as the frontier of fighting shifted ever further westward. So they have a very ugly record. And by the same token, there are, there is a certain nostalgia for them in Ukraine today. In recent decades, streets and public squares have been named after OUN leaders and fighters. There have been neo-fascist Ukrainian organizations that have sort of claimed the mantle of the OUN of the 1940s and looked back to it for inspiration as they once again fight for an independent Ukraine. The difference is that nowadays Ukraine is actually a multi-party democracy. The far right parties have had less electoral support in Ukraine than they've had in countries like Germany, France, and the United States in recent years. And the president of Ukraine at the moment happens to be Jewish. The Ukraine of today is structured fundamentally differently from what the OUN wanted to see back in the 1940s. And so while I do think that, like all countries involved in World War II, Ukraine at some point in peacetime, God willing, should have some kind of public reckoning with the legacy of its wartime experiences, which, by the way, also involved millions of Ukrainian soldiers fighting as part of the Soviet Red Army against the Nazis. Clearly, what Putin has done is latch onto one historical narrative and use it to smear Ukraine as a nation in a radically different historical context, one where clearly Putin's aggression against Ukraine is much more reminiscent of the fascist aggression of the 1940s than anything that Kiev's regime has done in recent years.
Many threads to pull on from that response, but I'll start with this. You touched on this briefly, but I'm wondering if you could expand. Ukraine's experience with far-right nationalists and some of the atrocities that they committed in their fight for this radically right view of nationalism, is that unique to Ukraine, or were there other peoples and nations that also took a similar path when they were under Nazi or Axis occupation?
Sadly, it's all too familiar a story that has counterparts in many other parts of Europe and the world. Even within occupied parts of the Russian Soviet Socialist Republic, there were, at the local and regional level, collaborators who were eager and willing to make common cause with the Nazis. The only, you know, one of the main hindrances there, as in Ukraine, was the Nazis' own reluctance to even set up client states or puppet regimes among populations whom they despised for their bizarre racist reasons, and who occupied territories that Nazi extremists hoped to populate with German settlers. So they could have had much more cooperation had they not been so short-sighted and narrow-minded in their own with their own ideological and racist agenda. In Croatia, the Ustasha regime was a fascist puppet state, which again wasn't based on electoral support, but was essentially parachuted into power by the Nazis when the more mainstream Croatian nationalists actually refused to cooperate with the Nazis following their invasion of Yugoslavia in 1941. In France, of course, the notorious regime based in Vichy under Marshal Pétain embraced openly collaboration with the Nazis as something to aspire towards. There again, the main hindrance to following through consistently on that plan was Hitler's lack of interest in according a collaborationist France any kind of notional equality in a future Nazi-dominated Europe. Those are just a couple of examples. Nearly everywhere there were where countries were occupied, there were some few who refused to have anything to do with the Nazi invaders from day one. Many people who just tried to keep their heads down and survive, and if that meant being cooperative or complicit in some ways, that was something they felt they had little choice but to do. And there was always an extremist right wing that eagerly embraced collaboration with Nazis as their own imagined path to power as part of a transnational far right paradigm shift. And I think we see echoes of that pattern in latter day politics as well.
Did these groups and these populations, did their views towards collaboration change as the war went on? For example, for some of these groups that were under, in Ukraine, I would imagine, too, that desired nationhood, when it became clear that the Nazi Party didn't have nationhood as part of their agenda, did their views change, or did they continue with collaboration nonetheless?
In some cases, for a time, collaboration was just not an option. When the Nazis were arresting them instead of empowering them, and they were arrested and had no choice. The Germans were divided among themselves. When we talk about Nazi Germany, we invoke the idea of a kind of monolith, but there were divisions between party and state, and especially between the SS and the military. The military tended to be more pragmatic and try to keep channels of communication open to potential local collaborators, even when officially they were banned or suppressed. In general, I would say what the key change came as the fortunes of war shifted. So from 1943 on, it became increasingly obvious to anyone who was, aware of events beyond, their personal ambit. It was increasingly clear that the Axis powers were not going to win the war, and were going to lose. It became a question of increasingly of when and not whether they would lose. And so that, of course, shifted the calculus of even many right-wing collaborators, although not all. With the OUN, for instance, they continued to operate underground even when they were banned. Then, as I say, there were some functional opportunities for renewed collaboration with the German military, even from 1943 on, even if officially they continued to be banned. But they also began to change their PR a little bit and to issue statements that tried to align them more with a sort of pluralistic democratic objectives of the British and the Americans, because clearly they saw that the Soviet Union was pushing Germany out of Ukraine, and that you know, the Nazis were going to be defeated by the Anglo-Americans in other theaters of the war, and so they were basically positioning themselves to align a little bit more superficially and rhetorically with the democratic ideals professed by Washington and London. And some of these leaders, you know, found refuge and exile in Western countries after the war, and tried to repackage and sell their legacy and their movements as being aligned with democratic ideals, and to downplay the role that fascist ideals and anti-Semitism had played in their movements.
After the war concluded, were there any attempts in Ukraine, and mindful that this was the Soviet Union, so this complicates matters, but were there efforts to engage with that history, or were there efforts by the Soviet Union and the Kremlin to rewrite that history in perhaps a different way?
Well, I mean, low-level insurgency continued in parts of what became Western Ukraine into the late 40s and early 1950s, but before being completely extinguished by Soviet forces. The Soviet Union, its ideology, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union and its Ukrainian branch prevailed, after the war, and their version of history became, the official textbook line. And, the OUN was not incorrectly painted as a fascist and pro-Nazi organization that, in the Soviet line did not represent the national will or interests of the Ukrainian people. The Soviets, of course, portrayed themselves as liberators rather than conquerors of Ukraine. That official line, which became part of the Great Patriotic War narrative, which became very influential in the Soviet Union from the 1960s on, that was sort of the established understanding of history under the Soviets. And of course, I mean, there was a lot of truth to it. The misrepresentation aspect had more to do with what was left out than what was included. So what was left out were things like the Great Famine that Soviet collectivization policies had unleashed in Ukraine, among other parts of the Soviet Union, in the early 1930s, or the brutality of political repression in Ukraine, as in other parts of the Soviet Union, throughout much of the period of Soviet rule, especially under Stalin, but also later, the story of the Holocaust was not part of the official Soviet narrative, during the bulk of the Cold War. So a lot of things were airbrushed out to present a simpler story of a Soviet good war, in which, the Red Army liberated the peoples of the Soviet Union, like the Ukrainians, from the Nazi yoke. And of course they did push the Nazis out, which was good, but life under Stalin could be, not much better for a lot of people, obviously. And so that part was marginalized.
And on that note, Dr. Rochwald, thank you for joining us. As a reminder, the views expressed in this podcast are the views of the participants alone and do not represent the views or opinions of Georgetown University, the Precision Guided Podcast, or any other agency. Thank you for listening to the Precision Guided Podcast. Follow the Georgetown Security Studies Review to stay up to date on the latest Precision Guided Podcast episodes and GSSR content. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn, or you can visit our website at georgetownsecuritystudiesreview.org.